It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferris. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, if you think we live on a strange planet, imagine how it would look to alien beings trying to live and make sense of how life works here. We'll talk to the author of the web comic Strange Planet. First, after more than 30 years on TV, the reality TV show Cops has been canceled. Cops, along with Live PD, a show of similar content that's been pulled for evaluation, have both faced controversy for the way they portrayed police officers on the job. And scripted TV dramas are also getting a closer look these days. All this comes at a time when protests against police brutality and systemic racism are an everyday reality, raising questions about our real-life law enforcement and what we see on the TV screen. Eric Deggans is a TV critic for NPR. He's the author of the book Race Baiter, How the Media Wields Dangerous Words to Divide a Nation. Eric, welcome back to Central Time.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Let's start with your thoughts, Eric, on the cancellation of Cops, a long-running reality TV show. Some people point to it as, you know, the origin of what we call reality TV these days.
It's one of those things. There were a few other shows that may have predated it. But this is interesting and seismic because people like me have been criticizing Cops for a very long time. We have pointed out that it tends to emphasize crimes and make them seem more prevalent than they actually are in the community. So you begin to think that the kinds of crimes that they show on Cops were, petty crimes and arrests. You tend to think that they're happening more often in your community than they are if you watch the show. There's always a fear that police officers have some sort of pressure to perform when the cops' cameras are doing ride-alongs with them. The police departments have veto power over the footage, so if a cop's crew catches them doing something unethical or illegal, they can always demand that the footage be destroyed. And I did a story back in 2005 about a Tampa police officer who told me that a cop's producer suggested that he wear the costume of a birthday clown when he was doing a prostitution sting. Normally, he would dress like a businessman and drive up in a sedan and pretend to be someone who, you know, wanted to procure the services of a prostitute, but they convinced him to dress like a birthday clown with full makeup and a rainbow colored wig and, confetti that he would sort of shoot at the women as he talked to them. And they even gave him a van that had the name of a fake birthday clown service on the side of it. So there's all of these concerns that they were inventing situations to make them more TV friendly. And people would watch the show and walk away thinking, well, that's how that police department, conducts a prostitution sting. So, all of these things sort of come together to create a situation where the show was misleading and the show was unfair. I complained about it for years. My original story ran in 2005. So to see that now they have finally been forced to stop making it, is it's a great thing. It feels maybe a little too late in a way, but I guess better late than never.
I want to give a listen to a clip from the show just for a taste if people haven't watched Cops over the many years it was on TV.
So we're going to a call of a suspicious vehicle. Apparently a vehicle's been abandoned and there's some sheets on it suggesting that somebody's been living out of it. It's also parked near a known drug house.
Hi there. Just curious what you guys are doing today.
We actually have been living out of our car, so we didn't have anywhere to go, really.
What's your name?
I'm Shelby.
And what's your date of birth, Shelby?
4/86.
86. 80, are you sure?
86, sorry.
So we've got a clip then making ultimately a drug-related arrest, a frequent fodder for the show. What do you think, Eric, was the appeal of Cops? It clearly had a long-lasting appeal to viewers, apparently.
Yeah, well, there's a couple of things that we find that's sort of consistent in certain kinds of programming. First of all, this sense that the viewer is allowed to sort of look down on the people who are the subjects of these broadcasts. and feel as if they're superior to them because they've made better life choices. You know, often these situations that the cops are shown getting involved in involve, you know, dealing with somebody who's made some bad choices. They've chosen to break the law, or they're suspected of breaking the law. As you heard in that one clip, you know, they're often dealing with people who have addiction issues and may be making decisions based in the grip of their problems with addiction. And so the viewer, the show was almost presented from a sort of middle class lens, where the viewer can sort of look at the people who are the subjects and say, well, you know, isn't it entertaining to watch these people who are making bad choices kind of forced to deal with the consequences of the choices that they've made? Now, of course, if this were an actual documentary, the filmmakers would spend more time with the people who are the subjects of the attention from police, and they might find out why they are in the situations that they're in, and they might find out that maybe they weren't making bad choices. There's a podcast called Running from Cops that has taken an in-depth look at the series. And one of the things they allege is that there's an episode that shows a man who was arrested after a substance was found in his car that was tested on the site and was found to be cocaine. And later they did testing at a lab and found out that it wasn't cocaine. Those portable tests are notoriously unreliable. And the police officer tested this substance three times before he came up with this positive, this false positive. And what they found is that, of course, there's no broadcast on Cops that says that the guy had charges dropped against him. The episode that featured him getting arrested was still showing in reruns, even though, you know, they had dropped the charges against him. He didn't have drugs. And, you know, theoretically, they were presenting something untrue, you know, alleging that, you know, that he had drugs in his car. So there's a lot of problematic stuff sort of wrapped up in how Cops encourages people to see things. But it's exciting, it's compelling, and it gives you the sense that you're seeing how policing actually works, even though you're not really.
Talking to Eric Deggans, TV critic for NPR, looking at the ways police are portrayed on TV in the reality, quote-unquote, shows like the just-canceled Cops and in the many, many scripted police dramas. And let's turn to those now, Eric. Why are police dramas such a common part of our TV diet going back for decades now?
Well, you know, it's one of the bedrock genres in television and film. Stories about law enforcement, and that makes a lot of sense. I think when you sort of consider the role that they play, it's natural for people to want to believe that their law enforcement systems, their judicial systems, mostly work, and that they are mostly accurate. That the people who are arrested and convicted of crimes most of the time committed those crimes. Now, we know that the actual facts can be very different, and we don't really have any way of knowing whether or not that's actually true, and there's a lot of evidence that maybe it isn't true. So law enforcement agencies realized a long time ago that it would help their public image if there were fictional TV shows out there that would make police officers and law enforcement look virtuous, look effective, and look accurate. So, you know, going all the way back to TV shows like Dragnet, and there was a show called The FBI that was on television a long time ago. These were shows that were made in cooperation with law enforcement agencies. And so those law enforcement agencies were able to insist on storylines that made them look effective and that made them look virtuous, and discouraged any attempt to interrogate where things might go wrong. What happens if a police officer makes a mistake? What happens if a police officer deliberately arrests someone that they know is not guilty of a crime? What happens if they never catch the person who committed a certain crime? As the genre got more sophisticated, we got to shows like Hill Street Blues that presented a more nuanced view of law enforcement, and we saw situations where the system let people down. And we also saw situations where you'd have sort of anti-hero cops, you know, cops who weren't necessarily, you know, completely heroic figures. But the for my money, the TV shows that best got at this was the show on HBO called The Wire and a show called Homicide: Life on the Street that was on NBC. Homicide was based on a book by the David Simon, who was then a crime reporter for the Baltimore Sun. And then David created a TV show about cops called The Wire for HBO. And both of those shows talk about how the system of policing that officers are forced to work in is very dysfunctional. Often it doesn't work the way it's supposed to. And sometimes it, oftentimes it doesn't matter how virtuous the individual police officer is, because they're trapped in a system that is dysfunctional and that has skewed priorities. And but those shows always struggled in the ratings, and those shows have always had a difficult time, I think, because their ultimate message is that the system of law enforcement that we use in America is seriously flawed. People get away with crimes all the time. Innocent people get convicted of crimes all the time. And police officers are mostly powerless to enact real change or stop that from happening. And that is something that I don't think a lot of people want to sit down with, you know, at 7 or 8 o'clock on a Wednesday night after they've been come home from work. They'd much rather see a story about a virtuous cop overcoming some obstacles and catching the bad guy.
We're talking with Eric Deggans, TV critic for NPR. We're talking about the way police are portrayed on TV, whether it's shows like the Just Canceled Cops or a lot of police dramas over the years. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Did you ever watch the show Cops or Live PD? What was the appeal for you? Do you watch other shows or movies where police play a big role? Do you think that the way police are portrayed needs to change? Why? Why not? Do you have a show that you think gets it right in some way? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We've heard from some of you on Facebook already. Russ says, I watch Cops occasionally. It's difficult to watch people during some of the most difficult times of their lives. I respect the police officers who deal with horrible situations as everyone watches and criticizes from a safe distance. William says, part of the problem with American society is we believe TV reality shows are realistic. We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our conversation with Eric Deggans, TV critic for NPR. We're talking about the way police are portrayed on TV and scripted shows like Law and Order and so-called reality shows like the Just Canceled Cops. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. What do you think of the portrayals you see of police on TV or maybe in movies for that matter? Do you think anything needs to change? Do you think what we see on TV affects our perception in real life? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll go to your calls now. Kurt is with us in Milton. Kurt, hi.
Hello. Hey, thanks for taking my call.
What do you think, Kurt?
I just wanted to express support for what's being discussed here. I am, you know, probably a beneficiary of white privilege and stuff like that, and have seen these kind of shows and thought, man, the police have a hard time dealing with these, you know, troublesome, drunk, drug overdose kind of people. But in my own life, with me and my family, we've had quite a number of incidents with the police where the police did not behave properly. It's not just the police. I believe it's the prosecutors, the assistant district attorneys, and people like that. You know, you show up for traffic ticket kind of thing where they didn't really know the law and you did. I've experienced this. And they have changed records and things like that to get a conviction for a $200 ticket. And you just feel like, why did they do this? So,
Kurt, thanks. I want to jump in. Thanks a lot for the call. Eric, Kurt's seeing differences in what he says he's seen from police and prosecutors in real life and what he sees on TV.
Yeah, well, often the way the criminal justice system actually works is very different than what's shown on television. I remember there's a great book out called The Divide, written by Matt Taibbi, who is a political correspondent for Rolling Stone magazine. And the book talks about how people who are considered unsuccessful in America are over-policed. And he talks very specifically about the stop and frisk laws in New York City before Mayor de Blasio stopped the enforcement of them. And what would often happen is that someone would get frisked. You're allowed to have a small amount of marijuana on you, but if you bring it out into the open in public, you can be arrested for it. So sometimes cops would ask people to turn out their pockets. If they had a little bit of marijuana in their pockets, they had justification to arrest them. Once they went into the system, they would be pressured by the public defender attorneys who were representing loads of people in their arraignments to take a plea deal to a misdemeanor rather than avoid taking up the court's time with a trial. And if someone believed that they were innocent and that they had been forced to put this substance out in the public so that they could then be arrested, they would get pushback from the judge, pushback from the prosecutor, and pushback from their own public defender lawyer, because the goal is to keep this machine going that is handing out misdemeanor pleas to mostly black and brown people who are the subjects of these searches. Now, you don't often see a TV show that recreates that sad reality, and that's because that's an unfair system, and it's depressing to think that there are things like that that actually exist within a taxpayer-funded law enforcement system. But they absolutely do, and people become convinced that their law enforcement systems work differently when they constantly watch Law & Order, or they watch CSI, or they watch any number of fictional cop shows where the system is much more functional than it may actually be in reality.
Thanks for that call. Go to Tom in Milwaukee now. Tom, hi.
Hi. I'd like to ask the guest about the. I think my perspective is that as children, as we're growing up, we're told to always tell the truth and lie is bad. There used to be a saying, the FBI always gets its man. And I think that there's this idea that when the government is controlled, it brings on happy endings. And so it's enjoyable to see a show like Cops, because that's the way it ought to be.
It presents, not only does Cops and Live PD, shows like that, present the idea that police officers always make or often make the right decisions when they come to a situation, that they usually solve problems, they don't create more problems, that there is more crime going on than is actually going on, and the police officers are our primary line of defense against all this crime that you think is going on but really isn't. If you talk to people who actually do ride-alongs with police officers, journalists, and documentary filmmakers, they will tell you, you can get in a car with a police officer and ride around with them for a week and nothing will happen. So, and of course they can't, on Cops, they can't show a camera crew hanging out with a police officer for an entire day and not getting anything. So, law enforcement is a great environment for exciting television stories, because you have this constant procession of crimes and criminals, dangerous situations, things that are very compelling to watch. But when you have a show that promises to give you an authentic look at policing the way Cops and Live PD does, and what instead they do is they feed you this steady diet of petty crime that emphasizes the troubles of working class people, the troubles of drug addicted people, the troubles of people of color, then you get a very skewed view of what crime is like in your community and in communities across the country. And that's often one of the biggest problems with this show.
Thanks, Tom, for calling in. Eric, in our last couple minutes, a lot of people are publicly wondering, do shows like Law and Order and the various franchises have to change the way they work now in the aftermath of the police killing of George Floyd, the protest. This feels maybe like a different moment. Are you expecting change in police shows going forward?
To be honest, I'm not expecting change in a great number of police shows. The formula for how they unfold has been set over decades of different television shows. And some TV networks like CBS, a primary bedrock foundation of their success is all of these shows that are centered on cops, heroic cops. And I don't expect that to change. What I do expect to see is that maybe we'll see some new shows that will try to portray policing in a more realistic way. And maybe we'll see some of these shows try to tackle a storyline or two that are more realistic. Law and Order is an example of a series that used to try to talk about the ways in which the legal system was failing people. In the first few seasons of the show, wealthy defendants would often get away with their crimes, even if they were guilty, because they had enough money to buy the best lawyers, to present the best defense, and they would overwhelm the prosecution, which is something that also happens in real life. When it first debuted, it was almost like a TV version of that Al Pacino movie, And Justice for All, which was a movie that was very much about taking a look at where the criminal justice system failed people. But I think Dick Wolf, the creator of Law & Order and a longtime TV producer, is a very smart creator of television. And he realized that it was much more profitable to create a show that fed people's fantasies about law enforcement rather than creating a show that educated them about the realities of it.
Eric, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Eric Deggans, TV critic for NPR. He's the author of the book Race Baiter, How the Media Wields Dangerous Words to Divide a Nation. He joined us today for a look at the portrayal of police on television. Still time to share your thoughts, by the way. You can do that over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up after the news, a new book of web comics holds a mirror up to everyday life and its challenges through the eyes of aliens. We talk to the creator of Strange Planet. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. A new report shows that the gender pay gap in Milwaukee County is shrinking, but there may be a bad reason for that. We'll dive into the numbers coming up. First, you may have spotted some aliens in your social media feed with a very literal-minded approach to everyday life. Today's post for the webcomic series Strange Planet involves a couple of common earthbound scenarios, and one of them, two beings talk about hating exercise. Except we never see the word exercise because the characters are aliens. And they don't know the earthling names for things. How was your strenuous activity? One asks the other. I despised it, is the answer. Fortunately, I was prepared. How so? I expected to despise it. Foresight, the other one concludes. Nathan Pyle launched the Strange Planet series of beings doing lots of Earth stuff early in 2019. It grew fast in popularity with more than 5.5 million followers to date. Nathan's newest book based on the series is out today. It's called Stranger Planet. Nathan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me, Rob.
Well, Nathan, I took a stab at conveying a comic strip in audio form. Never the best way to present it. But can you tell people a little bit about who maybe haven't seen Strange Planet, a little bit about what you're doing and what they see?
You did a wonderful job creating the comic in everyone's mind. Strange Planet is about a strangely familiar planet somewhere in the galaxy and somewhere in the universe. There are all these beings who seem pretty familiar. They drink jitter liquid in the morning and then they drink mild poison at night. And they try to figure out why they exist and try to find meaning in their lives through their many exploits and many adventures. And it's been fun. I've been creating this for 15 months or so. My wife and I started it, as you said, last year, and it's been a ride. We have 5 million people following now, and about half of them are from outside the United States. So we've learned a lot. We've had a lot of great discussions about human behavior in the midst of all this.
And I think I made a mistake. I called your characters aliens, and I think you actually call them beings. Why is that?
I always refer to the characters as beings because we're just getting a glimpse of them on their home planet. This is where they live. They'll see themselves as aliens. And I think it's one of the most useful aspects of Strange Planet that we would be pretty strange if someone were to observe us from the outside. And that's all that's really happening in Strange Planet. We're observing another species from the outside, and we get a chance to see how quirky and yet lovable they are.
Well, and that's kind of the main theme of the strip, too, is that we take the things that we human beings do all the time without thinking about it and looking at it with these beings who look different than us. I know it's a weird wrinkle. Why do we want to drink a bitter liquid in the morning, like you said, and then either a big glass of mild poison or a small glass of a slightly stronger poison, as you say in one of your strips, at night? Just, I don't know, it's a different look at our daily weird routines.
Well, it ultimately is a celebration of humans. We care a lot about each other. And I think it's part of why it's been successful is it's positive towards humans. We really do. We do absurd things like we make each other blow out candles on birthdays, but we do that to make sure that another person knows that we're glad they're still here, that they survived, and we want to honor them for making it another revolution around the star. And that's it's really fun when you realize, you know, there's so many of us out there who have come to similar conclusions. When I did one about April Fool's Day, I learned that in France they call it Les Poisson of veal, and essentially it's April fish, and they kind of draw a paper fish and they put it on each other's back is what my French readers were telling me. But it's just funny that humans all over the world came to this conclusion that it really is fun to lie to each other just one day a year, and they have to be a certain kind of lie. They can't be a consequential lie. But then the rest of the year we try to tell the truth, and we say truth is more important. But for one day a year, it's fun to deceive each other. So they have an annual deception day on Strange Planet, and it's all meant to be fun. And as you said, like there are choices. You don't have to drink the mild poison. You can drink a little bit of the stronger poison. But there's always choices to be made on Strange Planet. That's part of what makes every day so interesting.
We're talking to Nathan Pyle, creator of the Strange Planet webcomic series. A new book is out today, Stranger Planet. What was some of the original inspiration here, Nathan? I understand it had something to do with you getting married.
That's correct. My wife and I married in December of 2018. So February of 2019, we were cleaning up for a party in our small Manhattan apartment, and we could not fit all of our appliances on the kitchen counter. We wanted it to look nice, so we hid our toaster in the closet. Which doesn't sound that strange if you've been in a small apartment. You know, we all put our kitchen stuff in the closet if you're in a small apartment. But hiding all of our possessions so that our friends would think you know that we cleaned up is one of the first inspirations for Strange Planet. That you know these beings in the strip, they said that they did own things but they've hidden them, and that's part of what we try to communicate to our friends when they come over that. We usually would show you all of our possessions, but in this case, we wanted to show you how clean our home can look. But, you know, when I did the next one, it was about birthdays, and then I did another one about star damage. And that's as someone who gets actually pretty burnt in the sun. I really do look like I'm damaged when I go out into the sun. And it's just part of the human experience that we so often will talk about how good it feels to go out in the sun and get exposed to it a little bit and get damaged even. But that's part of our joy that we have these cycles every year where we get to get star damage.
You mentioned you've got people following you from around the world and you've learned about similar customs around the world. But what kind of response do you hear from people? How have they connected with the observations you make in your comic strip?
So often I hear that people are sending them to each other, their friends, even their parents or their children. One of the best parts of this is just that, you know, their entire families who send me notes and say, we've renamed everything in our home. We have new names for everything. And I think that's part of the joy of it. It's really a celebration of behavior on one hand, but also language. We have such interesting ways to create nuance when we call one beverage this, but another beverage we have a different name for it. And ultimately, they might be very similar beverages, but we create meaning with language. And I think that's one of the most fun parts of this, that I, as a person who speaks English only, I have yet to learn another language. But so many of my readers from around the world, they tell me that sometimes I'll name something in English, something that's much closer to what they use in their language. So I'm actually not reinventing anything. I'm just creating a slightly different version of English here.
Well, we've got a couple of favorite lines from our staff here. Technical director Sarah Hopeful says her favorite Strange Planet quote is one you just mentioned. I crave star damage, i.e. a suntan. And executive producer Judith Sears, Poisson. And we do celebrate Poisson d'Avril here at Central Time. Her favorite is respect the death blades, meaning watch out for the cat's claws. Do you get a lot of people saying, yeah, this is my favorite Strange Planet line?
Yeah, because we made over 400. My wife and I have made over 400 comics now, and it's so wonderful to hear that kind of feedback that someone enjoys one particular line. And you know, I just did the Deathblades comic a couple weeks ago, so it's been so fun, especially to see on Facebook more than any other platform. They will post pictures of their own vibrating creatures or their yelling creatures. All the different ways that we talk about dogs and cats on Strange Planet. And I get to see all the photos of the animals that are companions to all the beings who read Strange Planet. It's been really fun. So thank you to your colleagues for sending those in.
Now, this is spread on the internet, and this is like one of those upsides of the internet, because I'm trying to think of how you would pitch your comic strip to like a newspaper syndicate. It might have been a hard sell. there's these beings, and they say things in a weird way, and you really kind of have to see it to get it, and then it kind of spreads. People have spread it for you in a lot of ways.
What you're saying is true, that I'm fortunate to come along at the time I did, where I learned a lot about creating comics on the internet. But with Strange Planet, I found that the buy-in, as you say, it really is necessary for someone to start to read a few. And then, you know, you get a sense of what Strange Planet is about. And then you really start to enjoy it. And I think that's part of what the engagement is, especially on Strange Planet. There's so many people who come up with their own fun anecdotes in the comment section where they're describing their own life in a way that might make sense on Strange Planet. And that's just so gratifying for us. We love to see the interaction. And again, that's something you wouldn't get in the traditional, you know, printed comics. We get to see all the interaction, and that's been really fun.
I know you're interested more generally in creativity and storytelling, and Strange Planet is one of your outlets for that. How would you encourage people to, especially maybe while they're, you know, a little slow to get out and do stuff these days, to start to harness their own creativity and their own outlet for storytelling?
I have been posting videos in the past few months, especially instructionals on how to draw. Because one of the basic concepts any artist will tell you is that if you can draw the alphabet, you already know how to draw the shapes that you need to draw infinite number of creatures, infinite number of imaginary objects. But I have this one example where if you can write the word glitter, you can draw a dog. And so you take all the letters from the word glitter, and then you rearrange them to draw a dog. And what's really wonderful about that is it gives people a chance to realize, you know, the way I draw letters is unique, so the glitter dog that I end up drawing is also unique. And that's how, you know, narratives can be created. Your own spin on an old story is going to be unique. And that's part of what I try to describe to people in one of my books, 99 Stories I Could Tell. I tell people, you know, you have to describe something to your kids, and you can do it in a unique way. Makes me think of the movie Big Fish. I don't know if you've seen that, but I love the way there's a unique story to be told every day, and you can create and embellish some unique elements to it. And so that's what I do. I tell people, start by drawing. Start by trying to figure out what's one thing that you can draw, and then talk about why you are succeeding or failing at that drawing. That is in itself a story, and you don't even have to leave your house to do that.
Nathan, thanks so much for joining us today.
It's been so fun, Rob. Thank you.
That's author Nathan Pyle. We talked to him about his new book out today, Stranger Planet. You can follow him on the internet. His comic strip, his webcomic is called Strange Planet. Coming up, we'll take a look at a new report that shows that Milwaukee County's gender pay gap is shrinking, but maybe for a bad reason. That's up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, thinkers in the early days of the United States had two dueling visions for what the country's story would be, a place where people were bonded by common values like freedom and equality, or a country of a superior white race. We'll talk to the author of the new book, Union, The Struggle to Forge the Story of United States Nationhood. Now, men generally make more money than women nationwide. In fact, women working full-time make about 79% of what their male counterparts do. There's a comparable gap when you break it down for different racial and ethnic groups. A new report shows that in Milwaukee County, the pay gap is shrinking, with women earning about 85% of what men do. Next door in Waukesha County, women's earnings are only about 76% of men's. While advocates for equal pay might celebrate the smaller gap in Milwaukee County, our next guest says, not so fast. Joe Pietrangelo is a senior researcher with the Wisconsin Policy Forum. He focuses on economic development, workforce development, and transportation. He co-authored the forum's new report on Milwaukee County's gender pay gap. Joe, good to have you back with us today.
Thanks for having me back.
Well, tell us what you set out to find out with this report.
Yeah, so what we were trying to understand is just to see what the pay gap is in Milwaukee County and how it compares with the national rate, see how things are trending over time, and then to get into some of the details about how the gender pay gap may vary by occupation and what some of the big factors are that contribute to the pay gap.
So we mentioned that pay gap a little narrower in Milwaukee County than we see around the nation and shrinking, but there may be some bad reasons for that. Can you talk about why we see this narrowing in Milwaukee County?
Well, I think that the narrowing is generally a positive story. The progress being made is positive. We went from women earning a median of 81% of men's earnings in 2010 to 85% in 2018. So that was a positive trend. But when it comes to why Milwaukee County has a smaller pay gap than the national gap, that's where you get into it not all being an entirely positive story. And that's because the general earnings in Milwaukee County are a little bit lower than the medians nationally. So specifically, men in Milwaukee County make less than men nationally. So that's part of what drives there being a narrower gap here.
Right. I think the hope for people who focus on the wage gap between men and women, their ideal solution would be that women would go up to the level that men are at. The concern is if it's narrowed, but it's because men, at least in Milwaukee County, are getting paid less than men elsewhere. What accounts for Milwaukee County looking like it does compared to the rest of the country?
Well, like I said, so women actually earn pretty close to the national median in Milwaukee County. And I should clarify that we're talking about where people live and not where they work. And we really only focused on people who work full-time in our study. But essentially, we found that women in Milwaukee County make a pretty similar amount as women nationally. But men, it was an 8% lower median for men in Milwaukee County than nationally. So that's part of what drives the bigger gap. Then we got into looking at, how does this vary by occupation? And because one of the things that drives the gap is that women are still underrepresented in certain fields that pay higher wages. So, for example, we found that only 20% of Milwaukee County residents who work in architecture and engineering, and 21% of those in computer and mathematical jobs, a lot of the tech jobs, are women. So they're very underrepresented in those fields that pay higher wages. And they're more overrepresented in some of the occupations that pay lower wages, like office and administrative support is a good example of that.
We're talking to Joe Pietrangelo with the Wisconsin Policy Forum, looking at a new report from the group on Milwaukee County's gender pay gap. Joe, in addition to looking occupation by occupation, how about how much women versus men rise to higher ranks and presumably better paying leadership roles in organizations?
Right. So we also saw that was still a major factor in the pay gap, especially when you look at certain occupations like the legal profession, for example, where actually in legal occupations, the pay gap is the biggest among any. We looked at 23 kind of occupational groups and found the biggest gap in the legal field. And the explanation, or part of the explanation for that, is that women are very underrepresented as judges and still also underrepresented as lawyers, whereas they make up most of the legal support workers. So those are the paralegals and legal assistants that earn lower wages. Another example is management occupations, where women are equally represented as managers in general across, you know, all types of management positions. But when you get into the specifics, you see that women are still underrepresented as top executives, which pay the highest salary. So that's still part of what drives the gap in pay.
Do you start to look at solutions in your report, Joe, things that could be done to help narrow the gap further?
We did a little of that. So, one of the things that we found, in addition to the things I've mentioned, we found that differences in caregiving responsibilities were a big part of what drives the pay gap. A lot of national research at least shows that. And so, for example, with that, women are more likely to take on more of the childcare responsibilities and other caregiving responsibilities in their families, partly because that can actually limit their career options because they don't have the flexibility they need to take certain jobs or to ascend up to some of the highest positions. So we found in certain fields where more flexibility has been brought into schedules. Pharmacy is a good example, where the pay gap has almost been eliminated in pharmacy. And that's largely because workers have come to be more interchangeable in pharmacy, and schedules have become more flexible. And that tends to allow women to be able to still be able to take on, you know, a disproportionate share of childcare responsibilities without it affecting their career as much. So that's one thing that could happen, is more flexibility in scheduling from the private sector side. We also look at the public policy side and how an increase in access to affordable childcare and also paid family leave, both for women and men, can help to close the pay gap.
In less than a minute, Joe, we've got COVID-19 now. That's after the time period you cover in your report. But what kind of things are you watching for to see how this shakes out and how it's going to affect pay for women?
Yeah, it's a great question. Initial reports seem to show that women have been more likely to lose a job than men have so far in this recession. And so that could actually make the pay gap worse. But we also see on the positive side that in a lot of fields, at least, especially in higher paying fields, a lot of people have been working from home. Schedules have become more flexible. So there's an openness to new arrangements at work that may actually allow for women to close the pay gap, because those flexibilities are available and they're able to, access or work in whatever field without it being a barrier.
Joe, we'll leave it there for now. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Joe Pietrangelo, senior researcher at the Wisconsin Policy Forum. We talked to him about a new report he worked on. It's about Milwaukee County's gender pay gap. You can find some reporting on that study from the Wisconsin Policy Forum over at WPR.org/news. And you can share your experiences and how you see COVID-19 changing the way you work. Email us ideas@WPR.org. Yesterday on Central Time, we talked about the early history of tourism and tourist attractions here in Wisconsin. And as it happens, today is the anniversary of a big milestone in American recreational activities. On this day in 1884, the first modern roller coaster opened for business on Brooklyn's Coney Island. Now, there had been roller coaster-like attractions before using icy hills or out-of-service train lines. But inventor LaMarcus Thompson broke new ground with his freestanding structure of his Gravity Pleasure Switchback Railway. I mean, the name alone must have had people lining up. The switchback part of the name means that the ride didn't go in a complete circle. The empty carts had to be transferred back to the starting point. The ride cost just one nickel, which I guess was still real money back in 1884. But once you get on this thing, hold on to your hats. The ride cruised at the breakneck speed of 6 miles per hour. Part of the attraction was the bird's eye view of Coney Island and its surroundings. Roller coasters have gotten bigger, fancier, twistier, and scarier since then, but honestly, the Gravity Pleasure Switchback Railway sounds like it's right about my speed. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.